funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is there an absolute standard for human right and wrong, or are morals the product of culture? Consider an issue like polygamy. Most Americans consider it immoral to have more than one spouse at any given time. But in other parts of the world, plural marriage is seen not only as acceptable, but as noble and desirable, guided by convictions as strong as those that tell us the practice is wrong. So how might we determine who is right? And more importantly than that, what does the question reveal about our ability to know which ideas are morally pure and which are corrupt, or at the very least, mistaken? Stephen Lukes is professor of sociology at New York University. He examines these questions through the lens of great Western philosophers in his new book, which is called, simply enough, Moral Relativism. Stephen, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you very much. Well, I'm glad to be with you.
Before we even define relativism as opposed to absolutism, would you start us off with a definition of morality?
Oh, morality. Well, we can think about it quite generally, broadly, as being, you know, a set of ideas, principles, rules that concern what's good and bad, what's right and wrong, what constitutes harm, what all those things bundled together. It's very broad, and that's where I'd start, with that very general, broad idea.
So moral absolutism is the idea that there is one absolute set of standards that keep right and wrong in separate categories.
Yes.
Can you explain relativism? Because it's not exactly simply just the opposite of that.
No, it isn't. I guess relativism, I mean, people use it in different ways, but I think it's basically just the idea that what I believe is right and wrong is relative to my morality. And there's no way, and what you believe is right and wrong is relative to yours, and there's no, to your morality, and there's no way of deciding between us.
So it's too simplistic, really, to define relativism as the opposite of absolutism, and yet that's the way people tend to divide this argument up.
Yes. No, I think, you know, maybe we should just get away from talking about isms. I mean, I know my book's called Moral Relativism, and people often use the label. But, I mean, basically, I'm focusing in this book on this idea that we shouldn't judge other people. I think it's very widely thought, you know, it's very popular, this idea that very widely thought that we don't have a right to judge other people because everything's relative.
You say in the book that in examining this issue, the question of who are we to judge other cultures is a bad one. Can you explain why?
Yes. Well, I think it's a bad one because you need to think the whole thing through. I mean, we do judge other people. I start this way. I think and you began in a way with the question. We have these ideas about human rights. We think that there are principles, there are ways that people should never be treated anywhere on the planet. And we hold that idea quite firmly. And yet we also have this question, well, who are we? Who are we to judge other people? And I think the fact is we have both those thoughts. And the question I try to grapple with in the book is, how can we resolve this conflict?
One of the things you say that's important is that we need to distinguish, as we consider this, between ethics and morals. Can you talk about that?
Oh, well, that's, again, a question of definition. I mean, I think ethics, as I use it, we can use any words any way we like, but I think the distinction is ethics is a way of thinking about, you know, a way of life, the ideas that infuse or underlie a way of living, whereas morals tends to mean a set of principles that guide us, that apply, we think, everywhere, like rules, obligations, rights, that sort of thing.
So for people who believe that there is really one set of right and wrong conclusions, they will start with the idea that across virtually every culture, there are certain things that are taboo and certain things that are encouraged. Why can't we start there?
Well, a lot of people do start there. I mean, there are 10 commandments, after all. I mean, I think, look, just getting to the very end of what I argue in the book, I mean, I actually think there are many ways of living. There are many forms of life, if you like, forms of ethics, as I just defined it. And there's no one best way to live. So the thing that the question you started off with, like polygamy, I think polygamy is a form of marriage. It's a way of that people relate to each other in that way. sexually and in terms of living together. And there are many forms of that. And that's a multiplicity. That's a diversity. There's diversity of those ways of life. But there are also principles which we could call morals, which have to do with how people should be treated, whether there are harms that are intolerable anywhere. And those principles, I think, guide us as to, you know, what's intolerable, what's insupportable. So I would say, for instance, there are many ways of many forms of marriage, but for instance, violence to women, say wife battering, that's something that should happen nowhere.
Even though in some cultures it is accepted as something that is normal.
Indeed. And that's the big problem. I mean, you have, I think, let's say, for instance, there's a human right to not being treated, to not being having your body violated, let's say, or not being treated violently or cruelly. Let's call that a human right. You could say that there are many ways that people could relate to each other in terms of how they, you know, the forms of marriage, but how, but violence, cruelty, those things are in the sphere of human rights, and so they're universal.
And are human rights universally agreed upon?
No. Well, yes and no. I mean, there was a Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948 that was drawn up by the United Nations, and there's a set of principles which all the countries who signed that subscribed to. But, of course, there's a lot of argument about what they actually mean and how to apply them.
Can we tease out the influence of culture on the things that we consider to be human rights?
Well, that's one of the things I try to argue about in the book. It's very difficult. I mean, I think, but we have to think it through, and that's why I'm reluctant to go in for straight, like you said, straightforward oppositions between absolutism and relativism. I think what we talked about before, ethics, this is to do with cultural differences. And there you can certainly say that, you know, what counts as, a decent way of living, or what constitutes human welfare, there's a great deal of cultural influence upon that.
Stephen Lukes is my guest. He's professor of sociology at New York University. His new book is called Moral Relativism. Stephen, does the perceived source of our morality, whether it's based on religious tradition or secular conviction, does that have anything to do with predicting whether people are going to lean toward relativism versus absolutism?
You mean, are religious people likely to be more absolutist or relativist?
Right.
I think on the whole, people who are religious tend to be absolutist because any given religion gives you a set of beliefs which you think are true. And certainly the Pope, for example, I cite him right at the very beginning of my book, when he was elected, the first thing he said was that he was engaged in a kind of war against relativism. So that religious people certainly fear relativism as a doctrine which threatens the truth of their own faith.
It threatens the truth of...
I just wanted to add, sorry to interrupt you, but
sure.
I wanted to add that, of course, secularists also can believe, I mean, very fiercely in the truth of their beliefs. So, but I think on the whole, religious people tend to have a more clear, as it were, antipathy to relativism.
Do morals hold up to the same kinds of proofs that we might apply to confirm a scientific theorem or truth?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. And the first chapter of my book tries to approach that. I mean, these are such interesting issues. I think on the whole, we believe, don't we, that when scientists disagree, or when people disagree about matters of scientific fact, there's an answer, there's a right answer. And that in the end, all reasonable people will converge, that even if there are deep scientific differences, there's going to be an answer that experiment and all the rest of it will enable people to arrive at it. Whereas in morals, I think we've lost that belief. And there's no way, is there, of proving as in a way that would show, as a matter of certainty, that a particular set of moral conclusions is the right one.
So essentially, there's a limit to the use of reason to study all this.
Reason alone can't decide the matter, I don't think. All we can do is reason. We can try to persuade people by reasoning and by being reasonable and appealing to people to be reasonable.
Let's talk about what relativism has to do, and you referred to it a little bit before, but with the idea of judging other people's values. And there's this question of tolerance versus intolerance.
Ah, yes.
And you've defined them in sort of a different way than a lot of people who look at this might.
Yes, well, tolerance, you see, what I think relativism is the idea that what I believe is right and wrong is relative to my morality, what you believe is right and wrong is relative to yours, and there's no way of deciding between us. And what that leads to is not, I think, tolerance. That leads to being non-judgmental. That leads to abstaining from judgment. Whereas tolerance is another thing. I think when we're tolerant, we disapprove of something, but we don't interfere. So if I tolerate your, let's say, in the 17th century, you're a Catholic, and I believe in tolerating Catholics, then I don't like your Catholicism, but I don't interfere with you. So tolerance presupposes, it assumes a judgment, and it says, don't interfere, don't prevent people from believing what they believe.
On the other hand, intolerance presupposes a judgment as well, but doesn't necessarily demand interference.
No, you can be intolerant in your thoughts, but I think on the whole, intolerance leads to interfering with people, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so sociologists and anthropologists have been forced to confront these questions as they're looking at different societal structures and the way that they approach morality.
Yeah.
Can you give us some examples of the observations that have led to more relativist thinking?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a subject that anthropologists have been deeply in ever since the beginning of that subject. Anthropologists were very early on called cultural relativists, and they believed that each culture is a kind of whole, an organic whole, and has its own way of life. And in the early 20th century, there were anthropologists who studied, for instance, American Indian tribes like Ruth Benedict, and they celebrated difference, and they tried to say, well, you know, they live their lives. For example, you mentioned polygamy; they have their own customs, and who are we to criticize them? And this was very widespread. Now, you asked for an example. I mean, I think one very sort of striking example that's much discussed these days is what we could call female genital mutilation or female circumcision. Actually, even the question of what you call that is an issue. I mean, some people don't want to even call it circumcision or even certainly don't want to call it mutilation, because if they're relativists, they want to say, well, that's a practice. You know, removing the clitoris and so forth, that's what they do. Who are we to criticize them?
In the same way that we don't call male circumcision male genital mutilation, typically.
We do not. Mm-hmm. We do not. But there is, of course, a difference. I mean, I think that there's no doubt that female, whatever we're going to call it, let's call it female genital mutilation, does actually have serious health consequences and results in the serious reduction of sexual pleasure.
Stephen Lukes is my guest. He's professor of sociology at New York University. We're talking about his brand new book. It's called Moral Relativism. If you want to join us, you can get on the line at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New York University Professor of Sociology Stephen Lukes. His new book is called Moral Relativism. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. Stephen, when you talk about looking at this from an anthropological point of view, it seems to me that there are two ways that one could go about this. You can either look at a different culture and say different realities within that culture have led these people to different conclusions, or you could look at it from a sort of superior point of view and say less enlightened culture than ours means that we don't hold them to the same moral standard to which we hold ourselves.
Right. Well, that second way of looking at it, in which you made a distinction between, one makes a distinction between the civilized and the barbarians, the more advanced and the less advanced, that was very common until the 20th century, really. That was the old way of doing it. And essentially what I was saying before is that with the 20th century you got this rise of relativism, and I think ever since then anthropologists have been very reluctant to take that second view.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have an email here from Lanisa in Dallas. She says, when I heard the promo, I was excited to hear what I surmised was just this discussion on my individual right to decide what is right or wrong.
Yeah.
Are you aware that there is an eschatology principle that says this kind of thinking is the beginning of Armageddon, that every man does what is right in his own eyes?
The beginning of eschatology. Well, the beginning of Armageddon. Well, this illustrates very well what I was saying. I do actually think that from a religious point of view, this is the worst possible position to take, relativism. I mean, I think it's, and you certainly see this in the Pope. I mean, ever since he has, throughout his life, he has been deeply opposed to this. And I think every Catholic must be.
And not just every Catholic or every Christian, but pretty much every religious tradition.
Yes. Well, except there are, you know, ecumenical religions. There are there are religions who make a point of saying, well, there are many ways to the truth, and so on. I mean, I think, I don't know. I mean, I think there is a kind of religious attitude which is kind of very open to there being different ways that you can pursue. But on the whole, I think a religious attitude does dispose you to be very anti-relativistic, yes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to John in Dallas. Hello, John.
Hi, Chris. In my upbringing, the theological conception of evil was anything that separates you from God.
Yes.
But in our more modern and political sociological times, you know, evil has been broadened, I guess. And, you know, in some way, you know, we have this battle between how maybe Dostoevsky, you know,
yes,
conceived of evil and Crime and Punishment, and Melville conceived of evil in Moby Dick.
Yes.
How do you, either in your book or in your thoughts and beliefs, yeah, you know, conceive of evil in this modern world, and how do you kind of critique its use?
You mean critique the use of the word?
Yeah, the use of the word, both, you know, from, you know, we've kind of gotten duped, I believe, from our politicians that anything that is, you know, anti-American is evil.
Yeah.
And that evil is somewhere else. It's not in our own hearts or our own eyes or our own brains or, you know, in our own actions.
Evil is a term, it induces the maximum horror, doesn't it? And I think it's a word that's very easy to exploit. And I find it, you know, I find it appalling, for instance, and disturbing when President Bush said that the project was to eliminate evil from the world, as though that was possible. I just think that evil is the name for the things that are most intolerable, the things that we really can't tolerate, can't accept as being compatible with being human. And, you know, that's what these days the idea of human rights, I think, is meant to capture. I think these days we think in that way, insofar as we're not thinking religiously.
Is there any danger, do you think, Stephen, in overestimating the impact of culture and tradition on our morality?
Well, one of the chapters in my book's about this. I think that the term culture is dangerous, because especially if we use it as a noun, because it suggests that there are whole cultures that are somehow integrated and like kind of organisms, that everything fits together with everything else. I think any so-called culture, let's say American culture, or even the sort of tribal cultures that anthropologists study, are full of conflicts and disagreements. And so I think we can talk about cultural influences, but we shouldn't talk about cultures as whole.
What's interesting about that observation is that that's also the case within religious traditions.
There are
very few where everyone is completely in lockstep.
I absolutely agree. And I think we should always be aware that there are strong disagreements, including, as you say, disagreements among religious people. So we should always be aware of saying such and such a religion or such and such a tradition, leads to this or that conclusion. It's usually powerful people in the tradition or the culture or the religion that are dictating a particular way of thinking.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Stephen Lukes is my guest. His new book is called Moral Relativism. Let's go next to Tyler and speak with Nancy. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank
Hi.
You.
I had a comment on the polygamy view that we were listening to earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the anthropologist or biologist could actually confirm that by nature, human beings tend to be someone on the possessive side.
Say that again. They're unanimous about what?
Possessive, well, is that what you said?
By nature?
Well, I don't know if another correct word would be selfish or possessive with our spouse.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So humanly, I mean, I know that acceptance or toleration was being discussed earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I would accept the fact that I had to share my spouse, but if asked, it would not be my choice.
Right.
And I believe by nature that there creates a lot of insecurity, jealousy, and fear in us, knowing that possibly our spouse might have to be shared or is in a separate relationship. I mean, I go back when I was a teenager and first had my first boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
That was something that I was very worried about, sharing him or losing him.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think that basically as human beings, we do tend to be possessive
mm-hmm.
and selfish in our ways with our spouse.
Go on. Yes, finish. Go on.
Thank you. Personally, I would say that I would choose to, if I was given the choice, I would choose to be in a monogamy relation versus polygamous.
Well, I have to say, Nancy, I actually, personally, I'm absolutely with you. I have exactly the same personal views. But, like Chris was saying before, if you ask the question about culture, you then open up the question, well, you know, how do we know what we are really by nature? To what extent is your attitude, and indeed mine, the sense of possessiveness and jealousy, to what extent has this been, as it were, instilled in us by our upbringing? And to what extent, I mean, do we really know that this is a natural thing? I mean, there are cultures where polygamy is practiced, and I think it's an open question. It's not obvious that this is, something, what does biological mean? What does by nature mean? Does it mean biologically given? Or to what extent is this sense of possessiveness a cultural thing we've learned? That seems to me an open question.
What do you think, if it were possible somehow to know precisely what human tendencies that are related to our moral traditions, which ones are guided by our biology or our genes, if we could know that, would it make sense to start there in informing morality?
Yes, this is a big set of questions, and I have in one of my chapters sorry to keep referring to the book, but I do try and talk about this a bit. There's a lot of work on these questions. They actually go all the way back. These questions were raised by the philosopher Michel de Montaigne in the 16th century. The question, in other words, what comes from our emotion, or are we born? Is the way we think and the way we feel, is it instilled in us by what he called the grip of custom? What's the role of custom and culture? What's the role of naturally, innate emotion? These are such interesting questions, and people are still working on it. The answers are not in.
Yeah, what's really interesting about that question in particular is that it seems that a great deal of our morality and many of the things that we believe are right to do or wrong to do have to do with sort of fighting against what feels like the most natural urge.
No, that's absolutely true. And so that raises another question, which is, what's the role of reason? What's the role of, to what extent can we escape from custom by the use of our reason? And that, to what extent, in other words, are we able to control our natural emotions?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Martin in Reno. Hi, Martin.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
How you doing? I appreciate the comments, and I agree with wholeheartedly a lot of things that you're saying. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to say that that I have read the whole Bible and and Torah and the Book of Islam, and I have read it in that Book of Islam that the people are supposed to present their ideas to us, but not to judge. And I just wanted to make that comment because I was talking when you were talking last time. And I just wanted you to know that I, from my understanding from reading these three books, that they are not to force their idea or to judge either way about our way of life. It's just for them to present what they have in their religion and not ever judge or persecute other people because they believe differently. Hmm. I will. That's what I read in the actual Islam book.
Yes.
And I just... That is actually written in their own book. So I just wanted to say that because what you know, what's fair is fair, and well, you know, I give credit to what credit's due.
Martin, thanks for your call. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, that wasn't the question, but that raises a very interesting question. I mean, I do think sometimes you can read these. I mean, most of these books, all these religious books, these holy books, have got lots of different sentences in them, and you can read lots of different ways. But I would think that there is quite a lot of judging that Muslims do, just as Christians. And, of course, there will be texts which say, don't judge. Certainly, if we're a follower of such religion, we're subject to God's judgment, aren't we?
An email from Jeffrey says, are there really any relativists? There are certainly plenty of people who will expound a relativist view or even follow it when it's convenient. But
yes.
Relativism strikes me as a boogeyman that doesn't really exist.
Ah. Well, I wonder about that. I've sometimes wondered about that myself. People often claim to be relativists, but it is actually hard because when you're, as it were, thinking and judging and having to decide, you know, if you're facing a kind of moral question or a moral dilemma, you do have to make judgments, and it's hard to say, well, I mean, you know, who am I to judge other people when you actually have to make a judgment? But I think a lot of people say or think they're moral relativists. Perhaps the point that this person's making is that when it actually comes to judging, you can't really be.
What about judging oneself? How does this kind of play into that?
Yes, well, then the question is, by what standards do you judge yourself? I think the problem with a moral relativist, or the problem moral relativism raises is, you know, are you just basically just judging yourself by the standards of your own culture or your own morality? Or is it a kind of universal thing? Are all people subject to the same standards? That's the question.
Well, it also is difficult, I guess, if one chooses to judge oneself by the standards of one's culture,
mm-hmm.
or even a universal standard. That's one thing, and leads to a certain kind of behavior. But
yeah.
I guess if you get entirely relativist, you could judge yourself only according to what you seem to think is right or what you want.
Yes. Well, then you become just like a purely subjective individualist. I mean, I think one kind of relativist, for instance, to answer the previous question, I'm just thinking about it, someone who's deeply nationalistic is a kind of relativist, isn't he or she? I mean, that's to say, if you really basically think that the standards of your nation are supreme and the only relevant ones and other nations are to be judged by their own standards and not by yours, that's a kind of relativism.
But people would look at that and feel as if they were being entirely objective.
They would. Oh, certainly. I mean, I think perhaps that's your point, that if you're actually making a judgment, you believe you're being objective. But then when you step back and say, well, where do these standards come from? You think, well, you know, who am I to judge other people?
And then you get to that point where at some point it has to stop and you've got to make a decision one way or another.
Yes, indeed.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Shannon in Arlington. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hello.
How are you? Thank you very much. Very interesting show.
Uh-huh.
I have a couple of questions. First, the concept of devil or evil in biblical and Quranic manuscripts,
yes.
Do I take it as a symbolic language? Therefore, if I take it as symbolic language, everything that comes and mentioned in the books has to be read symbolically, or was there really physical devil created? to misguide Adam and Eve? That's one question. The other question is, I am more personal involved in it, in a setting that you're sitting with your friends discussing whether religion or poetry or world literature, assuming that there's like 10, 15 people sitting in there, there's always one person that is trying to be kind of domineering, imposing ideas.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that. Nobody says that. But you're so conscious and you're thinking, here's the ethical question. Do I oppose the person or just swallow the ideas and just go along with it?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Well,
it's
very interesting. I think the second question you've kind of answered yourself, haven't you? I mean, if you have that thought, it's a question of courage, isn't it? I mean, if someone appears to be dominating or domineering your discussion and you're critical, then, if you're aware that he's doing that, then you're already on the way to criticizing and rejecting him, aren't you?
And as to the question, I know you're not a theologian, but as to the question
yes.
of evil personified.
Well, that, you know, I don't write about that in the book. And it's a kind of question addressed to me as a person. What do I think? I actually find it very hard to believe in the devil as a personified being. I actually find it hard to believe in God as a personified being, too, to tell you the truth. I'm not one of those people who just dismisses religion or regards it as kind of, a set of illusions. I think there is a lot of deep truth in religious texts. But in answer, trying to answer the questioner's question very specifically, yes, I think reading these texts symbolically is probably the way to go.
Stephen Lukes is my guest. He's professor of sociology at New York University. His new book is called Moral Relativism. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can get on the phone at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stephen Lukes. He's professor of sociology at New York University. His new book is called Moral Relativism. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Stephen, Walter Isaacson, the biographer of Albert Einstein, is convinced that Einstein fueled the rise of the modern version of moral relativism in the 20th century, in that in this universe where suddenly time and space became relative, many thinkers began to lose faith in the absolute truth and morality that they had understood before. What do you make of that argument?
Well, I don't believe it. I'm not a physicist, but I don't see really the connection. It seems to me, this goes back to a question you asked me earlier, it seems to me that in matters of science, we actually believe that scientists get things right in some absolute sense, and in the sense that they get it objectively right. Now, you know, it's true that, of course, Einstein was the inventor or discoverer of the principle of relativity, but what that means is that Einstein supersedes or includes Newton. That's to say, Einstein represents an advance in scientific understanding of the way the world works. So I don't see, although he has discovered something called the relativity principle, it's not as though the truth of what he's discovered is relative.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Rebecca in Carrollton. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello there. It's an interesting discussion. You made a statement earlier, or a distinction, rather, between morality and human rights. And I'm wondering how a distinction can be made under this line of thinking, since there seems to be a need for some kind of measure at which point the line is crossed into a human rights issue. So, for example, you said that a wife battery would be a human rights issue.
Yes.
But I think that could be likened to the discipline of children, and at which point have you struck a child too hard or too frequently that it becomes abuse. So how do you make that distinction?
Oh, this is a very good question. Thank you for it. I wasn't meaning to draw a distinction between morality and human rights. I think it was ethics. I said that ethics is a way of living, and there are lots of different ways of living. For example, different forms of marriage. But that I was trying to say that moral principles we tend to think of as applying universally and to anyone. So that if there's a way in which people are harmed, let's just say the human rights are violated, we think that there are ways that people should not be treated anywhere on the planet. Now, if you take, for example, I'll come to your point about disciplining children in a second, but if you take torture, for instance, if we think torture, as I do, and I'm sure you do, is a violation of human right and something that shouldn't happen, it shouldn't happen to anybody. It shouldn't happen to anybody anywhere. It's a way no human being should be treated. Now, then move back to something less extreme. Discipline. There, I think, there's all kinds of complexity. For instance, in tribal societies, in the third world, let's say, beating your wife, your wife, would be seen, could well be seen in let's say, a local context as disciplining your wife. So what's the right way to think about that? Is it disciplining your wife, or is it wife battering? I think that it's not as though I've got an answer to that. I think that in a way the struggle for human rights, which for example NGOs, non-government organizations engage in across the world, consists in trying to push back the line, trying to persuade or get people to see that what they think of as disciplining your wife is actually a form of wife battering, which isn't, I don't have an answer to your question, at what point does disciplining your children become abuse? Because I think that's not something we can just decide over the radio.
The wife question is interesting, and it's difficult to consider, really, from within our culture, because I think a lot of Americans would argue with the idea that one even needs to discipline one spouse. There's you know,
yes,
argument, but it's hard to even sort of get there and meet them halfway.
That's right. No, I think that human rights, as it were, the idea of human rights or the principle of human rights advances when disciplining your wife, i.e. another adult equal to you, with whom you've contracted a relationship, that can't be thought of as discipline that you're entitled to engage in. So, yes, I think that the principle of human rights advances as that idea develops across the world.
An email from Kelly asks, do we have the right to be intolerant of intolerance? For example, if one feels another race is inferior to their own, do those of us who disagree have the right to judge those moral perspectives if they are not harming others in the name of that perspective?
Well, I think we don't. I mean, I think that we have the right to be intolerant of intolerance if that means engaging in practices which violate people's rights, put it that way. That question was a complicated question, but I think the answer is, if I understood it, that we have to examine what we think of, what we can possibly mean by inferior. Which of course raises the whole issue of moral relativism. I mean, in what ways can people be inferior to others? Sometimes these are factual questions. Sometimes they're matters of moral judgment.
I guess her question is it okay for her to be intolerant of racism?
And I think the answer to that is yes, because racism is a practice of that involves violence and cruelty and arbitrariness. There are all kinds of, I like getting away from isms. And if by racism we mean things like discrimination, practices that involve cruelty and so on, then of course we can talk about those specifically, And but also racism means thinking that another people, I mean, for one thing, it involves thinking that people constitute a race that's biologically defined, and that's also a factual matter which we can dispute.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Sharon in Dallas. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. My question or my comment is about moral relativism in conjunction with a singular foundational value. For me, that would be alleviating human suffering.
Yes.
And so it would be morally relative, but not towards the culture. It's not how is my behavior, you know, is it appropriate in my culture or not in my culture? Is this behavior moving toward that value in light of the social circumstance that one finds themselves in?
Mm-hmm.
So the rules would change for every place. You know, if you're on a ship, the rules are different than they would be if you're in Dallas or if you're in, you know, Afghanistan.
Yes.
But they would all be focused on that primary central value that everyone would seem to want to value.
Yes.
Of course, it would create some need for sacrifice of an individual's well-being, you know, since it was human suffering as a whole.
Yeah. So you think of that as a fundamental absolute principle?
I think for the moral relativism to work for me, there has to be a singular absolute.
But why do you call
value,
but why would you call that relativism?
I guess because I would say, well, somebody says, is it okay to have multiple spouses?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it depends on if that in your social situation is promoting that central value. And if it is, because that's a way that works for that, you know, if there's two men and 500 women or 500 women and two men, that may be appropriate.
Well, I think, you know, I think you're on the way to a very interesting idea there. The only problem I have with it is that one principle of avoiding or reducing human suffering, well, it's okay. I'll join you in supporting that, except what about asceticism? What about those ways of life where suffering is actually part of what people think a worthwhile human life consists? What about the acceptance of suffering?
Are moral values more about what we should not do than what we should do?
I think they're both. I think they're about both. But I think the idea that, I mean, I'm kind of with you. I don't like to see suffering. But on the other hand, some people, there are ways of life where suffering is thought of as part of what constitutes a good life. That's where I think moral relativism starts to enter in, where we recognize that things we take for granted, like you're taking for granted the relief of suffering, are actually not taken for granted in other places.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Rebecca in Richardson. Hi, Rebecca.
Oh, hi. I had a question about at what point does somebody who tends to be a relativist have to become a little bit absolutist in terms of, for example, something that every gay person has probably dealt with is, you know, I want to be okay or I want to be accepted, so therefore I have to be more accepting of the people's point of view. And then you get hurt by, you know, people who say, well, you're wrong. You know, I love the sinner, hate the sin sort of thing.
Yes. Well, that issue of gays, homosexuality is a very good example, just as polygamy is, of the diversity of culture, of cultural norms, and the fact that certain ways of living are, you know, from one point of view, just regarded as anathema, totally unacceptable, and yet they are, you know, they are ways by which people can live lives which they regard as decent and non-harmful. So I think the attractiveness or the appeal of relativism is to recognize that fact, that you know, that diversity.
Have you ever considered, even as a thought exercise, how the world might be different if every human being were either a relativist or an absolutist?
Well, I mean, in a way, the way I try to end, the way I end up, I try to argue, the way I end up my book is to say that there is actually something, and I've just referred to it, actually, something deeply appealing about relativism, namely that there isn't one single best way to live, but there are many best ways to live. But nonetheless, there are principles that set a limit to that, and we call that human rights, ways in which people should simply not treat each other or be treated. And so I don't think we should be either absolutists or relativists, to answer your question. I think we have to find a way of reconciling two intuitions. On the one hand, the intuition, the thought that there are many best ways to live, and on the other hand, the idea that there are ways that people should never be harmed. There are ways in which people should never be mistreated.
So parallel truths can exist.
I think these two isms, or absolutism and relativism, you have to find a way of reconciling or finding a way through this apparent conflict or contradiction.
And you do think that the two systems of thinking can be integrated in some cases?
Well, I think it's a struggle. You've got to think it all through. But I think there is something. Let me just say something about what someone said earlier. I mean, you know, I think that someone said, is there anybody who is really a relativist? I find that young people, undergraduate students, tend to, when I teach this subject, they tend to come and say, oh, yes, of course, who are we to judge other people? Who are we to judge other cultures? And then when I raise the issue of female genital mutilation, there's some sort of, something goes, a kind of barrier reaches. They reach a kind of barrier and they say, oh, well, of course, not that. That's not acceptable. So the thought, in other words, that there are just different ways of life meets a limit in which people say, well, no, but that's not acceptable.
How important is it that people of each viewpoint strive to understand each other?
I think it's important to try to figure out what these issues are and not to get locked into either a kind of fierce belief that your system of morals is just the right one and other people are just wrong. And it's very important to kind of see that moral relativism. What I think is that one's got to try and understand what's attractive about it and where its limits are.
And how can relativists and absolutists sort of effectively share power in the real world?
Well, I don't know if I would put it that way. I don't think, what I've been trying to say is I don't think people are either relativists or absolutists. I think even people who have an absolutist way of thinking, I think they should be brought. They can be brought to see that their absolutism is unreasonable. But perhaps I'm being over-optimistic.
That's a good thing. Stephen Lukes is professor of sociology at New York University. His new book is called, simply enough, Moral Relativism. Stephen, fascinating ideas in a tiny little book and just an hour to talk about them. But thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.